All right, welcome back to Noise Avocation Podcast. I'm Ryan here with Jeremy.
What's good?
So normally we'd have some music for you in the beginning, but our episode this week is a little bit different. So if you've listened to Gate Creeper, Tomb Mold, Worm, the new Slime Lord that just came out on Friday, which if you haven't heard that, you definitely should go check it out. That's out from 20 Bucks Spin. But anyways, I could keep listing bands, but the guy that we have as our guest today, Brad Moore, has done the artwork for these album covers, which if you've seen them, you know how fucking crazy they are and how sick they are. It was really cool to talk to him. Like, he's been doing this for, I don't know, over 30 years at this point. And I think he has a really unique style, and I think it's cool to be as excited for the album artwork as you are for the music when a record comes out. I think that's important, especially in like metal music, because some of the same covers can get reused a million times.
I found this interview very insightful and educational, like, in for me, you know what I'm saying? Because like you said, this isn't something that we normally dip into, but I'm so glad we did.
Me too, because he was a lot of fun to talk to and just a real cool guy all around. But if you look through the episode description or the episode itself on Instagram, we'll put in a slideshow of some of his artwork. That way you can see the albums and stuff themselves, since we are currently not doing video. But stay tuned for that, because we'll be changing that soon. But other than that, check out Blast Beats Vinyl. The link is in the episode description for that, and their Instagram's on there as well. Follow us, follow them. If you're a first-time purchaser, you can use our discount code for 10% off your first order, which is NOISE, all caps. And you can find that in the episode description as well. Jeremy, unless you got anything else, we'll jump into the episode with Brad.
I've got nothing, man.
All right. Enjoy. Thanks for listening. Brad, first and foremost, thanks for taking the time to jump on the show. We appreciate it, man. How you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. It's good to meet you guys in kind of this odd techno way.
Yeah. I don't. Have you done podcasts before, or like kind of like?
I've done video podcasts where we actually show the artwork, hold up the paintings, and things like that. But never just an audio only. So I'm kind of wondering how it'll go without visuals. But I'm ready for it.
We'll on the episode, we'll tie in a bunch of your visuals and stuff. So it'll work out.
Oh, then that'll work. Yeah. So that way, good. I didn't have to bring anything. that's like, and then worrying about whether there's glare on it and all of that.
Right.
Now, oh, no.
Once I get to posting everything, we'll, I'll post a few pictures throughout the episode. And then, like, I always make up episode artwork. So people will be able to check out the artwork. And then we'll kind of put links to it in the episode description and that sort of thing. But your artwork's awesome. Like, you know, first, before we get really into anything, like, it's cool to be talking to you, because I've own quite a few of the albums that you've done the artwork on, and I know Jeremy does as well.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah, man,
I appreciate the support.
Yeah, we do this podcast in the back of my record store, so I actually have a few of the albums that you've worked on up front right now for sale.
Oh, great.
So how did you get into doing artwork for metal bands specifically? Like, were you doing art beforehand, or did you just kind of start off in that, or how did that happen?
I got my start right out of art school doing writing and drawing horror gore comic strips for underground comic books. And that was there was a thing called the black and white comic book implosion that was happening then, where a bunch of independent publishers sprang up out of nowhere because of the new distribution systems that were coming about at the time. And they needed artists and writers big time. And of course, I was fresh out of the gate from art school and ready to go. Well, I felt like I was ready to go. When I look back on the old work, it's cringeworthy, but I got hired right away to do interior art, but also freelancing inking and coloring for other people. Like, if you've ever heard of the comic book Faust or Razor, I did inking and coloring for those kind of things. And it was off and on. That was all supplemental income. And then I got to work with Fathom Press, which is Tim Tyler, who's a famous comic book artist. And he was the publisher and owner of that company, and gave us a lot of free reign to just create. It had to be pretty much, I would say, X-rated, absolute gore fest stuff. And it was just a blast to see if we could gross out each other. And then, but little by little, what was happening was that we were getting banned in places and stores were refusing the books and all that stuff. So when metal came along, what had happened was the bands that were on tour, either in their vans or buses or whatever, they would pick up a bunch of these comic books to read on the road during the long trips. And they started getting a hold of me and other people like Vince Locke, you know, the guy that does Cannibal Corpse. He was a comic book artist. He worked in Dead World and all of that. They got a hold of all of us and said, "Hey, can you do t-shirt graphics and perhaps even paint album covers? What do you think?" And I was ready to do that because the comic book ship was kind of sinking at the time, only because distributors wouldn't handle all this heavy duty stuff. Is getting, I've been banned in Canada, the UK, and Michigan, believe it or not. So awesome. yeah because of the Jeffrey Dahmer comic book, I'm in that, and so I got banned in that. And then I did a comic book about Elizabeth Bathory that I think they had my name on a list. They banned it there.
Welcome back
Well, when I say banned, what happened was it couldn't be sold in a comic book store.
Right.
They rerouted sales into tattoo parlors, record stores, et cetera, et cetera. The only thing is the rerouting takes time and you're waiting on your paychecks. So I started doing the metal stuff on the side. And what you've seen, you know, in the ensuing years is it's all switched. I only occasionally do comic book work now, and it's 98% metal work, you know, for the merch and the album covers and flags and posters and all of that stuff. So that's actually how it came about. The very first death, I did some thrash and some punk and some other things, mostly cassettes, but the very first death metal album cover was Morpheus Descends, The Ritual of Infinity.
What year was that?
Probably 90. People tell me it's 92, but I clearly remember it being 91, and I remember writing 91 on the back of the artwork, but maybe it didn't come out till 92. We're talking quite a while back, and I was a kid then.
Yeah, according.
And then right.
I'm sorry, yeah, but according to the internet world, 92 was the release date of the album. But like you said, yeah, you could have done it in 89, and they held on to it. You know?
In 89, I did a thrash cassette for a group called Aaron Toll. It was real technical. Who would it be like the band like Coroner or anybody on the Shrapnel label and all that stuff. You know, everybody was into that Satriani speed hand tapping stuff, you know, but real aggressive. And that helped. It stayed kind of regional, but it was like, all right, good. You know, and then I did a gothic artwork for a gothic 7-inch for a band called October's Child that were briefly on MTV. And I kept thinking, oh, this is gonna explode any minute. You know, I wouldn't say it exploded right away, but after I did Morpheus Descends, the record company, which was JL America at that time, immediately commissioned another work for Organic Infest. And oddly enough, just last month, this Organic Infest album was re-released through a Chinese record label. So after all those years of obscurity, it's back again with a great big poster of my artwork. I love the fact that's been one of the new trends, is to put a big poster of the artwork inside.
We also love that trend.
Yeah, what that, especially on like the Worm records that were recently done, the big posters that were in there. I have a few of them hung up in my basement at my house. And
yeah,
I love the artwork for that stuff.
It's such a cool bonus to get.
Oh, it is. And it's a kind of throwback to the 70s when you'd buy an album and there was a whole lot of entertainment inside the album, which you don't get with a download. And, you know, but people constantly send me photographs of the posters that are included in the albums, like from Gate Creeper on up to Worm and a lot of Worm. And they're in their practice pads or their rec room. And there's even a couple of them that were hanging up in their van.
Oh, like their tour van or something?
Yeah, they'd hang, put it on the ceiling.
Oh, that's dope. Like
that. Yeah, I know. That was great. So, you know, have a little folder with all these that people have sent me. You know, I just recently saw one where somebody, it was a Gord Embrace. They're in Chicago, and they had a Gate Creeper, one of my Gate Creeper cover as a great big flag or poster on their wall at their practice pad. And that was just 2 or 3 days ago that they sent me that.
So how does it feel to have, like, your art? You know, people, like, obviously, you're awesome at what you do, but like, how does it feel when you have all these bands and all these people putting your posters up everywhere? I mean, like,
that's the best part of it. And I discovered that feeling back when I was a comic book artist, when I got a letter, this is before the internet, actually, I got a letter from Sri Lanka, and a guy had said, oh, I got 2 issues of this and you're my favorite horror artist. And I thought, my gosh, these books go to Sri Lanka. You know, I had no idea. You don't know, you know, what the distribution is and all that stuff. You don't, because you're working for a company and they deal with it, not the artists. That's when it suddenly hit me that I can sit in my little studio, and it's small, my little studio in Southern Illinois, and create something that somebody in Sri Lanka or somebody in Czechoslovakia is actually going to see, and then more than that, actually appreciate it. And I, you know, there are a lot of haters. I've gotten mail from people who just think it's terrible and all that stuff, and want to tell me what I'm doing wrong, and all that's all going to come with it. But for the most part, 95% everybody is very appreciative, and they really like it, and they're interested and want to know more and what's going to come up next, and they want to be involved. And, you know, and I do my best to involve them and include them in that. So yes, that is the best part of this whole thing, is the communication, the sharing of all of it, that I can do something here, send it to the publisher, the record company, and it's taken care of, being, you know, sifted throughout the world. And yeah, so that's hands down the best part of it. That and the paycheck.
Yep, right.
Right. So when a band reaches out to you, do they already kind of have an idea of a theme they want, or do they just kind of entrust you to go with your style of where you want it to go?
It's a combination of both. There have been times where they'll say, we're in such a hurry, what have you got on hand? That's happened a few times. You know, finished painting that's on hand. And I'll say, like, what's the mood you want? And if I have something like that, I'll show them. Most of the time, though, it is, here's what we're looking for. And I'll chime in, and there'll be a good hour, 2 hour talk back and forth, either like we're doing now or just with text back and forth and sketches. And I've had to bend a few of the bad ideas. You know, I'm not going to say that I'm, you know, the greatest and the smartest and whatever, but there's been a few bad ideas that I was able to talk these guys out of, and they were so happy later, you know. And then there's been times where someone has just the perfect concept. Like, for instance, the thing I just finished, the Slime Lord cover, has just an incredible concept to it that immediately turned on my imagination. And we're just doing pencil sketches, or I'm doing pencil sketches and sending them back and forth to England. And it was yes and no, but mostly yes. And, you know, some things just require a slight modification to do this massive wraparound, you know, this total organic hellscape. I almost hated when the project was over, because I was so into what I could do with this. It was very specific, and yet it gave me so much freedom. Whereas there were the other ones, like the ones I turned down are the ones that are real cliche. Like, okay, we want to have a priest and he's got a chainsaw, and you know, and or I got a, you wouldn't believe, this is the truth now, how many have said, we want to have a clown and he's reaching in his chest and pulling his heart out. This has happened at least 10 times. I'm not nice. kidding you. And one of the worst ever was, I won't say the band, it's nobody famous, I can tell you that, but I met with them. They said, hey, we're going to be, you know, near you and all that. And I said, yeah, we can meet and I'll bring a sketch pad and all that. So we did all that. And their idea, I said, what are your ideas? And I'm ready. And the first idea was, okay, we've pictured 2 staircases on the left and right, and they just go up and up and up. And he looks at me like, this is the greatest idea that's ever been done. And I said, and your second idea?
Right.
He goes, that's not good. I said, it's really not good. I said, you're supposed to evoke, you know, you guys are like speed, thrashy, deadly, and all that. That just doesn't do it. I said, what's the next idea? And he goes, all right, next idea we're not as into, but Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, but every leaf is a razor blade.
Yeah, dude.
Well, I said, well, okay. And I said, that's a better idea, because, but think about this massive undertaking of painting the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, that is a lot of razor blades.
Well, just imagine, the Garden of Eden is supposed to be mind blowing.
Right.
You can't just show any garden. It's got to be a real head trip, you know. And it's like, so I said that, and I had the idea that the Tree of Life would have like the Egyptian eye of Ra in it, and I was going to have all these things. But no, they balked, and it's a really good thing, because the band ended up not not doing anything. And one of the worst ones that ever happened was I was on the phone and these guys said, okay, here's what we want. It's a giant robot. And this robot is just slaughtering people like in the old Godzilla films, knocking down buildings. He goes, I want it to be real futuristic and bizarre looking and all that. And it's just make it the goriest thing you've ever done. Just crunching people left and right. So I'm writing all this down already, just my head full of good ideas for this. And then here comes the kicker. The robot only kills people of color.
Oh, that's fucked up.
Yeah. So I turned that down right away. Of course, immediately he calls me a puss and a wank and all this stuff. And so I sat there with my phone and listened. And I said, all right, you've spoken. And now I'm going to have my say. And I, as I'm talking, of course, he doesn't give me my, he's not polite. I was polite to him and let him say everything.
Right.
I let him, he called me. And as soon as I start talking, he just, I just hung up on him. And it's a band you've heard of, but I'm not going to say their name.
Yeah, that's funny. That is messed up, though. I mean, just
that's terrible.
Have that idea. Like, because when you originally said that, I was thinking, like, a more gory version of Queen News of the World type of thing, where the big robots got, like, the person in their hand and shit. But
yeah.
It sounded rad up until the cool fucking up racist to that point. Oh,
why have that?
I was going to have stuff launching off the shoulders and everything. You know? Yeah.
Yeah, that's
well because they were a white supremacist band. I better not say anything else, but you know that's just and I would believe they're still around, but we just don't need the hail of hate coming in. We just don't need it, you know. Yeah. So just leave it at that. Yeah. But a good story about that Queen News of the World. It's based on a 1950s painting by Kelly Freeze, who did all these science fiction pulp magazine and book covers and stuff. And so the original has this robot with, but he has human eyes, if you've noticed, and he's holding his creator and he's accidentally killed his creator and he's looking up to the heavens. So it's very meaningful. Queen are a big fan of this guy and they got a hold of him and said, can you like just alter it? And he goes, oh, I'll repaint it. I'll paint a brand new one. And it'll be you four guys. Just the one we're all used to. We've all seen, you know? Right. And so the story was that he said that when he painted that cover originally in the 50s or 60s, whenever it was, he got invited to Cape Canaveral or NASA or whatever it was to see a rocket launching because he's a science fiction artist. And he said when the rocket went off, that was the first time he'd ever seen concrete ripple. When he did this album cover for Queen, after it was all out and everything, they sent him concert tickets. He went to see them live, and he said that was the second time he saw concrete ripple. He wasn't prepared for how loud a, you know, rock concert's going to be, especially in the 70s. Yeah, it tore his head off.
So your artwork is, I mean, there's a lot going on in pretty much all the stuff that I've seen you paint. Do you have, like, a particular process to starting a painting, like, or do you just kind of, something comes to mind, you start there, and the rest kind of stems from that?
It starts with the concept that we, you know, like I said earlier, that I discuss with the band.
Yeah.
And, you know, we throw in the good ideas, throw out the bad ones early on. Usually it's not a wrestling match if there is a bad idea. I mean, I'll give them, I say, here's why this doesn't work. I say, I'll do it, but here's why it doesn't work. And I'll show them. And they're going, oh, what will we do in place of that? And then I'll show them the alternative and it works. So it starts with pencil sketches. I just take a picture of it with my phone and we just go back and forth. Mm-hmm. And as soon as they go, yes, we're onto it now, I'll lay some tracing paper over all these sketches. I got lines going everywhere and eraser smudges. And then I trace off in good, clean lines everything that we agreed that was good. Then I take a picture of that and show them. And I said, here's my idea now for the composition and how it wraps around. If it's a wraparound, if it's just front only, here's where the space where the logo will go. And thinking of that, here's how we're going to put in these ideas and such and such. And there's usually a list of things that they, of items or ideas that have to be in there. Not always, but that's how it goes. So it starts with pencil. Once they've okayed it, and of course, their manager has to okay it and the record company has to okay it.
Right.
There's a few people that have to like it, you know. But once that's in place, then I'll sometimes wash in with watercolor or markers, just an idea of what the colors are going to be. Sometimes I just take a blank piece of paper and I'm mixing colors and all that. And I said, okay, this is going to be the mood. I'll just simply show them the mixed colors. It's not even in the drawing. And I'll say, this is the mood. This is going to be the palette, roughly. What do you think? And 9 out of 10 times they love it. You know, sometimes it's like add something or take something out, but they always want it to be darker. I think that most metal bands, if you let them, every single album cover would be black. I'm not kidding you. And so you got to talk them out of that. The second thing is most album covers are going to be green. And I like green and I like black too, but they can't all be that way. If you go to a merch table and they're all black, and how many times have you gone to a merch table and they're black and white covers? I don't mean the ink drawings, but I mean the, you know, the real washy and real gothic-y and all that stuff. And after a while you're going, wow, 30 of these, and they're all kind of blue and gray and black, you know? So I'm always looking for a color scheme that still has the morbidity. It still has the sense of wonder, still has all that, but I'm big on that. Let's use some colors and things. And so I'll show them. And that usually works. So color is the next step. And then after that, I take the drawing after they've okayed, they've said, yes, begin. And here's the deadline. And here's all that. And here's your down payment, blah, blah, blah. Then I put colored chalk on the back of the drawing, put it on illustration board, because I don't work on canvas anymore. I put it on an illustration board and carefully trace it off. And what that does is when you lift the drawing off, it is lightly in colored chalk on the illustration board, which is white. I then pick a background color and a small brush and trace over, do the entire thing as a line drawing in paint, sometimes in ink, but mostly in paint. And that way you can see everything. Then I wash over it. I choose a color, which is usually an earth tone, not always, but usually it is. When I say an earth tone, a neutral brown or a burnt sienna, raw umber, that kind of thing. And I wash over the entire thing with that. And that solidifies the ground and gets it started. Then colors go on top of that. So when it has a unified color in, as the background, or at least to start with as a support mechanism, then it all comes together and it doesn't look like images are pasted together on there and here's something that doesn't quite fit or whatever. It all looks, no matter how wild I can put something in there, it'll all look unified, like it all belongs in that scene. And that's really the working method for all of it. And then I send about every 2 to 3 days, or sometimes just at the end of each week, I send the progress pictures and they'll mull it over and say, oh, you know, make this brighter or that looks good or add a little bit more of this or whatever. You know, we kind of volley back and forth. Like on the cover for Blue Worm, Blue Nothing, we were on the phone. I was on the phone with Phantom Slaughter, I mean, every half an hour to an hour, just back and forth towards the end of that. I'd say, now is this part this and this is that, and certain things that he wanted that I kind of steered him in a different direction that came out a little better. And, and there were certain things that I thought maybe it didn't need, but I put in there. And then later I'm looking at it and going, yeah, that worked. But like I said, we were pretty much on the hour. Here's what I got now. And he would get right back to it. That's good. Or move this over, or one or two more of the whatever, you know. And it was just this true collaboration to make it work. And he was happier with the Blue Nothing cover than he was with Forever Glade. And I'm just the opposite. I think that Forever Glade is a much stronger painting. There's nothing wrong with Blue Nothing, but I just, Forever Glade represents the kind of album cover I want to do. And Blue Nothing was the kind of album cover he wanted. So it was, you know, a give and take, but that's what it's about.
I think,
you
know, they both one... really complement the album sound though. Like, cause Blue Nothing,
yeah.
I mean, both albums were very, Worm has that distinctive sound, but Blue Nothing was a little more hollow and like darker sounding. Whereas Forever Glade, when I found that record and I was pitching it to people at my store, I kept calling it like swamp metal because it sounded just swampy, dirty, gritty. Yeah. And the album artwork really, really complimented that too.
And as I was doing it too, that whole scene is supposed to be underwater. It's a sunken crypt. And slowly we took out the schools of fish that were going to be in it. And then we slowly took out floating seaweed and things. It was kind of interrupting the picture. And I said, if we take out too much, people won't know what's underwater. So I added some, I left bubbles in there. And if you look, there are bubbles floating in some of the right places.
Yeah.
And that way people will slowly put together that it's underwater. I'd say if a few people, you know, toking their favorite weed will suddenly go, dude, this thing's underwater. You know, they didn't see it with a straight mind. You know, that happens a lot. And wanted to give the idea of a sunken crypt. And we went through a few sketches, but the one that you see is far superior to the first ideas. And he originally wanted the Gloom Lord, the guy on the right hand side sitting on the throne. He's dead but alive. He's undead. You know, that's the best way to put it.
Right.
And he wanted him just completely wrapped in seaweed. And in my first drawing, it worked. When I started laying in the colors, it was like, I said, let me show you what it looks like without a whole lot of the seaweed. And then he said, oh yeah, take all the seaweed out. Don't wrap it around him, but have it floating in the water. And then after a while it was like, don't have it floating in the water. Let's just take all that out. Make it happening in a realm of cosmic horror, Lovecraftian cosmic horror kind of thing. And then let them slowly piece together that it's a underwater scene, which is also maybe in an underwater dimension. You know, it's open to interpretation, which is the best way to go. You shouldn't be too literal. You should leave it, because people like to gather around while the record's playing, look at the artwork and talk about what they think it's about, what they think they see in it, certain things that they didn't notice the first time, didn't notice the third time, you know. And I've gotten people who have written me little short messages about what they thought it was about and where they thought they saw things that I actually hadn't put in there, but it was like, that was interesting. Because, and see, that's good. It opens up their imaginations, which is what you, this, the biggest thing I'd really like to say about this is capture someone's imagination. You know, if it's a priest with a chainsaw, we've seen that 10,000 times. Enough, you know. Yeah. Enough. There's at least 100 of those. So let's do something else. And I'm not going to say I'm the most original, not by a long shot, but I like the idea of a fascinating concept. And the Worm albums have a great atmosphere. Atmosphere is key. And then also have a tremendous concept, because Phantom Slaughter is a real thinker. If you talk to him on the phone or see his interviews, he's a real thinker. When he gets a feeling, he wants to communicate what he feels in the music he writes to you. And I've told him, I just felt like a light went on over my head when he said that. I said, because that's what I say. When I get a feeling that I want to put in the painting, I want the viewer to get that feeling too. And I never know if they do until, of course, they tell me. And some of them, it communicates right off the bat, you know. And then there's other people. You won't reach everybody,
right?
But like I said, to sum it all up again, if the atmosphere is key, the concept has to be really good, and it just has to be a true collaboration. And the two Worm covers I did, plus some of the merch I drew for him, were all really, really, really good examples of a great collaboration.
Yeah, I've noticed that you have a thing for like creatures and stairs, because there's a lot of albums where there's staircases kind of randomly leading to, you know, like Worm has kind of like the tip of the castle there, and then like some of the other ones are kind of just going into it's hard to tell where they actually lead to, but like you said, it's an open to interpretation thing. But lots of cool creatures, lots of cool insects, and stairs.
Yeah, the stairs were his idea. Well, in my first drawing for Everglade, I did have 3 or 4 steps at that top part. And he goes, oh, more of that, more of that. We got to have more of that. Twisting stairs that maybe go up to a closed doorway or an open doorway, and there's not another room on the other end. It just opens up into the marsh.
Right.
He goes, just, we got to have that. And then he said, on Blue Nothing, he goes, I do want to continue. I want to have the Gloom Lord, and you know, he's in there on the bottom left. And he said, and I do want to have more stairs in this. He goes, and some bigger and some smaller. And I said, yeah, we both had landed on the same idea that it's two or more realities closing in on each other. That's why there's more than one moon in the sky. And there's in fact, the name of that Blue Nothing painting is Bat-Winged Maggot. And if you look to the right of the skull, there's a flying maggot with bat wings.
Yeah.
A lot of people go, oh, there's a dragon. It's not a dragon. It's a flying maggot. And that's what I named the painting, was Bat-Winged Maggot. There were going to be more maggots, but he said, well, we don't want the gore aspect, just the doom, you know, gloomy doom aspect. But one of the things I like to say is when you look at the Gloom Lord and he's holding a candelabra, it's a really small candelabra because the Gloom Lord is really big. He's a looming presence. You know, we're not going to say how big and all that because that limits it, but you want to understand, it's like that, you know, candelabras are fairly large and it's really small in his hand. Right. He's a really imposing presence. But look at his shape, if you've got the album cover handy. Yeah, look at his shape at. and then look at the lightning that's on the other side. The lightning is the exact same shape as the Gloom Lord.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, negative and positive space. So he is, that could be how he appeared in the picture, you know, through that lightning, like that's a portal. But instead of putting him in the lightning, I put him over here. So that you'll look back and forth, and after a while go, hey, you know, look what's happening in this area here. You should have seen Phantom Slaughter's original pencil sketch for his first idea for it. He would kill me if I shared it. It's hilarious. It's like your little niece in fourth grade. And he admitted that. He goes, this is a rough, don't laugh and all that. You know. Yeah. I showed people. I said, yeah, this is what they want me to do. And he didn't want me to share. I said, all right, I won't share it around. But I wanted to. It was hilarious. to turn it into this malevolent, ultra depressive atmospheric thing. And his drawing, especially of the dead guys that are on the right hand corner going towards the graveyard, he just drew little ghosts with smiley faces. It's like three or four of them.
That's what I would do, Sue, to be honest. Like, all right, this smiley is supposed to look evil, but you're the artist.
Supposed to be a skull. It was the smiley face. It was supposed to be skulls, but he says that's why I'm hiring you.
Yeah, makes sense, I suppose.
Yeah.
So when you finish a painting, do you keep the painting yourself, or do you give it to the band, or do you sell it, or what do you do with them?
I keep the paintings and sell them through galleries and at exhibits. Okay. When I say galleries, they're usually at like convention-like things or three-day metal fests. Stuff like that. Like I'm doing a store signing next month in Chicago at Meteor Gym Records for when the Slime Lord album drops, and I'm going to have some originals and things there. And yes, everything, there's always things for sale, there's been many times that I went to the Maryland Doom Fest about, probably 2019, like right before COVID, and made $3,000 in the very first hour. Because I sold a painting and two or three color prints in the first hour.
Wow.
And it was I had a painting of a zombie biker riding through a graveyard because it was supposed to be the album cover for a tribute to Nazareth. Remember, there was a band in the 70s called Nazareth.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and now you're messing with the son of a bitch. Well, anyway, all the modern death and doom bands and sludge bands and all that were all going to do a Nazareth song, and they got me to do the cover. Well, legality stepped in, and there was a big problem. So I never got to use the cover. It never got published, but it was really a fun, cool painting. And this record exec came up and bought it. He's just like, oh, what's it? So I told him the whole story about it, and he was on his phone a lot and all that stuff. And he came back and he said, how much is it again? I said, $3,000. He goes, I'm going to give you a down payment to hold it. He goes, I'll go to the bank and I'll see you tomorrow. And he did. He came up with the rest of it. And that was in the first hour. I mean, I just set up. So in the first hour, that and a few color prints had already been sold, and I made over $3,000 in an hour. So I'm awesome. Not saying this to brag, but I'm trying to say this is a big part of how a living is made,
right,
as this kind of illustrators. And it has nothing to do with bragging. It's just to give you an idea, because when people say, well, how much money can you make? Can you make a living at it? I make a living at it. I don't know how everybody else. People will ask me, how much does Mark Riddick charge? I don't know.
when you guys hang out and talk about the shit.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I was sitting over beers going, dude. Nothing like that. Yeah, nothing like that. I mean, I have no idea. They said, Dan, I do kind of know what Dan Seagrave used to get, but does that mean that's what he charges now? Is it more? Is it less? I don't know. I barely know Dan Seagrave. I've talked with him online like three times maybe. And that was just trading technical tips. That was it. But they always assume that, he's my next door neighbor or something like that. No. So, when people ask me that stuff, I said, go and ask them. I said, but one thing is, I said, on a public forum, you shouldn't really be talking about your finances, because the next guy will just undercut you going, oh, that's how much he makes. That's how much he charges for a record cover. I'll charge $100 less and take all his business.
That's shooting yourself in the foot.
It is. So you don't want to be, telling people your business. But so my prices depend on how big it is, what it was used for, because a bigger painting, of course, has to cost more. Wraparounds, of course, cost more than the front, that kind of thing. Yeah. So when people say, what's a ballpark? I said, well, we talk privately on that. I don't put prices on, like at the exhibits, I don't put prices on the paintings. You have to inquire. Of course, if you put a high price on one of them, that's a good. You're just asking for one of them to get stolen.
Oh yeah, for sure. Somebody will come and snag it right off the table.
Oh yeah, right when you're not looking, because there's always a crowd of people. There's a lot of people, and that's what happens or could happen.
So the painting that you sold for $3,000, what was the size of the painting?
That was good question. About 36. No, 20. It was matted and framed without the mat and framing. Probably 12 by 24 or a little bit bigger around with the mat and with the frame, about 30 inches maybe.
Okay.
long, you know.
Yeah, I was just trying to get a rough idea of the, you know,
how much price grand will get you.
Yeah, the shit, you know.
I have so many different sizes. I could have, that might be slightly an error, but largely they're painted just a little bit bigger than they are when you buy the album. Okay. Usually 1 or 2 inches bigger all the way around. In the case of Coffin Mulch, Spectral Intercession, I painted it smaller because his deadline was so tight, but I so much wanted to work with them. I even told him, I said, I can't fit that in. I'm going to advise you to, you know, get a hold of somebody else. And I gave him some names, and he got back and he goes, well, what will it take? And I said, well, I could paint it smaller, and I have magnifying lenses to work with. And so I painted it smaller. And of course, nobody can tell. When you look at it, you can't tell that it's any different, that there's any different approach to it than anything else, because I used magnifying lenses and just painted it smaller. And I was able to get it done in time for his deadline. I just really wanted to do that. That was a rush job. And the funny thing is, Blue Nothing was also a rush job.
So when the album comes out, is there, like, we'll say it would, since we were on the topic of Worm anyways, like, if it's painted larger, is the whole painting compressed down to size for the record, or is there stuff left off of the actual cover?
Compressed down, yeah. Okay. And which makes a tighter presentation. You can go a little looser with the painting, because actually that really works better. Your eyes will pull it together so much better. If you paint it real tight, you get that plastic cartoony look. And the thing is, I'm a real tight painter as it is. Mm-hmm. I'm struggling to sometimes let it be a little more brushstrokey for that reason, and for one other reason. I've had a lot of people who said, I'd like this cover a lot better if it wasn't AI. I don't do AI, but they've looked at it and thought that it was.
Right.
You know, so I'm trying to let a little more of the brushstroke, a little more of the character of the paint show, you know, so maybe that'll get that miscommunication out of there, you know, because no, I've never done AI and I don't intend to ever do AI.
Do you use a particular kind of paint that you prefer, like acrylic or anything?
It's liquid. It's a Dr. P.H. Martin Spectralite liquid acrylic.
Okay.
And then occasionally there's another, here I'm looking at it right now, there's another type, got a foreign name to it. It's Belgian. My God, I can't even remotely pronounce it, but I always just pick it up. It's a Ott Belieber. No, I don't know. Yeah. It's from shipped in from Belgium, but you can get it at this place where I shop. And largely that. Once in a while, less than once a year, I'll do a watercolor like I did. If you ever saw Divine Empire's Doomed to Inherit, it's a multi-armed goddess demon looking thing. Like you opened up a tomb and there it is, you know, and there's a dancing little demon girl in front of it and all that stuff. I keep saying demon. I really like that. It's like a lost civilization kind of thing, you know, and it's a real monochrome effect. You know, it's a lot of grays and all that stuff. And I remember them describing it. I said, we want him to have Freddy Cougar flesh, you know, this multi-arm thing. They wanted it to have 48 arms. And I found a way to do it. But I said, guys, it's really, nobody's going to look at all these many. You really should have less arms and it'll look like more. So when I redrew it and showed them, they agreed. But yeah, see, that's another time where I had to kind of talk him out of it. I drew it with 48 and I said, but let me show you what happens.
Holy
if we just
shit.
Knock it down to about 20 or whatever it is, 18 to 20.
Okay, and I can see that it's doesn't got look more like 48. I mean, there's a lot.
No,
there,
oh
but
no. Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah, but it's, and you know, and I said, plus I can get the hands in there and put a lot more character in them. And I did that in the pencil drawing. And he was like, yeah, okay, you're right. Now, if we had just done that over the phone, you know, I wouldn't have been able to convince him because he was just absolutely livid on that's what it's going to be, you know. But when I showed him, you know, gave him a visual to look at, it was like, oh, yeah, you're right. So now again, another, you know, time where I was able to wrangle a better idea.
You said Blue Nothing was a rush job, you said? How long did that take?
Yeah, I had to shoehorn that in. I also illustrate for two book companies out in the West Coast, and I was in the middle of one of their big projects. It had a wraparound cover and 10 full-color illustrations inside. When he got a hold of me and said, I'm going to need this in 4 weeks. And it's like, whoa. And he says, well, 4 weeks is enough. And I said, well, you know, I work every day as an artist, and I'm going to have to work on that like on nights and weeks. Here and there, you know, but it's a front only and not a wraparound, and that helped a lot, you know. So managed to get it in there, got everything done, you know. It was a chore, but you know, it's what I do. So I'm not going to complain about it, but it was kind of shoot. At first I said, I'm really not certain I can get that in there. And he showed me that sketch and I was cracking up and I said, yeah, I said, I can improve. I said that I can improve on that sketch, you know? And so, and when we got started, I got hooked. It was like, yeah, you're right. Send me the contract, you know?
Awesome. Glad you did.
I send out my contract actually. Because if you wait for a record company to send you one, you'll be waiting and waiting and waiting. So I have a nuts and bolts contract that I send out, and then they fill it out and send it. But as soon as I get it and the down payment, kabam, I start, you know, right then and there. Awesome. And start sending progress picks like the next day or so, or as soon as I have them, which is usually within a day or two.
Yeah, you said earlier that you really like color, which I'm glad that you add all the colors that you do, because I'm a big color person when it comes to artwork. Like all the old Ed Repka stuff and things like that, like the colors all popped on the albums, and I really appreciate that more. Not that there's anything wrong with a dark black and white album cover, but when you get this crazy like landscape to look at, it's just so much more appealing to me.
I agree with that. I agree. Like I said earlier, I'm trying to talk bands out of the black, white, and gray look. They all want to be the most bleakest, darkest, grayest. And I said, there's ways to get bleak and dark with colors. There are, you know. And like, look at the Forever Glade cover. I mean, that's really bleak and horrific in a lot of ways. And it's got orange and green in it, you know, and some blue and things like it's got all, I'm not going to say cheerful colors, but it's got colors that work, you know, that look good together. It's not grotesque.
Yeah,
color-wise,
they're not just a black and white contrast palette. It's like all over the place. But I mean, it has its kind of set brown and green type of color. But if you look in there, there's a lot more going on.
Yeah, and I mixed a lot of purple in with the brown. So because purple is the opposite of green, and it's a contrast to green, and therefore you can get the green to jump off there without making the green bright.
Right.
You know, because you can have that bright frog green, and that just that might work for science fiction, but it doesn't work for a horror, gothy, gloomy, you know, funeral doom kind of thing. So it's got to have that, you know, but I didn't want it to just be all gray and drab. And so I showed him some colors right off the bat. He loved the colors I picked right off the bat. Now, all I did was make a bunch of swatches and just show him on paper, you know, and just took a picture of it and sent it in. I said, here's my idea. What do you think? He goes, oh yeah, excellent. He goes, just keep the dreariness and keep it, you know. And I said, well, it can't be lightless, like too dark. It's got to have illumination in odd places.
Right.
So that thing, you know, so it makes some kind of sense. And so if you'll notice, there's little spots of light, but you don't know where they're coming from in there. And that adds to the idea that it might be in a different dimension, you know. So because Dave at 20 Bucks Spin even said, he goes, it's kind of perplexing where the light's coming from. And I said, that is on purpose. Yeah, so it's not just, you know, it's like, we're looking at a theater set and these monsters are like puppets walking into it, you know. I wanted to sidestep that kind of feeling.
So you said a lot of people will send you your artwork hung up. Has anybody sent you tattoos that they've gotten of your artwork?
A couple of times, yeah. The very first one was Morpheus Descends. A guy got, there's like a spiked head in the lower left-hand corner of it, and he got that part of it tattooed on the calf of his leg. And then there's been a couple of others. I can't recall exactly what. There haven't been that many. I've had people tell me but not show me.
Okay.
So a couple. So yes, the answer is yes, a couple of times.
Yeah, I think like one of your landscapes would make an amazing like full back tattoo. I mean, it would take forever because there's a lot going on, but it would make a really cool tattoo.
That guy would probably he'd probably be dancing on my grave when he got that done. Especially the size of somebody's back. Yeah. Imagine the Gate Creeper cover, all as much stuff as I put in that on somebody's back.
It would be sweet though. Yeah, just you'd to have see to find the right guy. But you'd have to have the right artist for sure.
Cause yeah,
could you really don't have, that up.
You don't want to have somebody not do the artwork. It's due diligence.
You're right. No, absolutely true. You know, and I sometimes grit my teeth when I wonder about how it's going to come out on the shirts, because all of my colors are mixed. Because when people say, what color is that green you're using? What color is that brown you're using?
Just make
it. I mix two or three together. I rarely ever use a color straight out of the bottle. Yeah. Every now and then it'll be like, well, that's perfect. But it's rare when it's, you know, they're all tempered. And I have a mixture that I put in almost every color that's white, gray, a thing called Bonnie Blue. And stir it all together, and it makes this kind of like a nasty brown, kind of like if you eat a chocolate fudge sundae and how discolored the milk is on the bottom of your bowl. It's kind of like that. And I make it real thick and I mix that in with color. So if I have red, that's mixed in there. If I have green, that's mixed in there, and it holds everything together. So that way, if there is a bright color, it doesn't stand out as any brighter than one in the background or one right beside it or whatever. Yeah. And yet when people look at it, they go, wow, you've got some bright colors in there too. And it's just cause it all holds together. I'm trained. I've actually went to art school and we learned what they call the old master techniques. It's not really the old master techniques, but the way they did colors, everything fits together a lot more than the modern artists that just throw things up there. And my idea of that is that, you know, they take a dog, throw blue paint on it and say, this is my feelings about Somalia, you know, and you're thinking, well, how does that show us that you know anything about painting or whatever, you know, just because you used paint, you know, if I hung a violin on the wall, I'm not the world's greatest violinist. So there's that, you know, and I pride myself on the fact that I have some technical knowledge and how to put colors together and some really odd ones that will come together and still make a good morbid scene.
Yeah, I think you're doing a fantastic job at that. So definitely keep up what you're doing.
Well, thank you very much.
What are some of like the favorite album covers that you've done over the years?
Well, we've mentioned, I've got my list here. I've done so many. I bet I've done a lot more than you realize.
Looking online, there's quite a few, but I'm sure there's a lot that aren't even listed just in like Metal Archives and stuff like that has a list of some, and then other places have some too.
Yeah. One of the ones I've got coming up for a band called Child Bite, and it'll be coming out in a few months, is one of the best I've ever done. I mean, and it's one of those, as I was working on it, I was thinking, dang, this thing is coming together. It's just like, this is incredible. You know, here I was not burned out, but just right off the tail end of working on Slime Lord. And then was the very next gig was Child Bite. And it was like, and they're on Phil Anselmo's label, Housecore. And it was just coming together like you couldn't believe it. You know, I was like, wow, it's just, this thing is just, you know, like in the zone. So when that comes out and everybody will see it, that one, that's really one of the best I've ever done. But when you say that, one of my favorites, there's a stoner doom band way back called 60 Watt Shaman. And I did this big gatefold painting for them. I'm proudest of that because, you know, as I told you, the concept has to be good. And the concept of this one, there's three women in the picture, but they're all three of the same woman at different points in her life. And all the things that are happening around her and all that. And then in the end, you read it from left to right, when you get to the right hand side, she's nude on a dinosaur skull, meaning that she's dead. And in fact, several times I've used nudity to indicate the soul, because, you know, the soul is not going to be wearing pajamas or something. So, you know, house slippers and, you know, Hello Kitty backpack. So that one, if you look it up, they couldn't put a whole lot of it on the cover. This was on Spitfire Records. It was a little conservative back then. They weren't sure about all that kind of stuff. They said, yeah, we need to, you know, hold it down, keep it down. I was like, oh. So anyway, it's on the inside. And then they printed big posters of it and all that. I'm super, super proud of that one. I go back to that one and show people a lot. It's kind of forgotten these days, but who knows? It might get reissued. But that one's one of my favorites. But if I go through all this, there's almost too many to list, to tell you the truth. The one I did for Spinebreaker recently, I did two for Crotch Ripper, and they're not a big band or anything, but they're kind of near your area, Northern Illinois, Michigan, up in that upper peninsula. They're up in there. They're kind of disbanded now, but I did two album covers for them that were just a hoot to paint. I mean, I had an absolute blast. When I look at them, you can tell, I can tell how much fun I had with them, because technically they just shine like a dollar, you know. So I'm happy with that. The Tomb Mold painting, of course, from Manor of Infinite Forms. But one of the ones I'm really, really into that most people don't mention is the one I did for Sedimentum. Have you guys seen that?
I don't think so.
Yeah, Sedimentum with an unpronounceable album. Separation Morphogenesequa.
Yeah, I'm sure I couldn't pronounce that to save my life.
Yeah. Well, the concept of that album was, it's a science fiction concept, and it's Earth couple thousand years after mankind has been wiped out, and vegetation is desperately trying to regrow flesh. So you'll see on the cover, on the front part of it, it's a wraparound, on the front part of it is a tree like a female tree body.
Uh-huh.
Almost, it's giving birth to a corpse. In other words, it gives birth, but the corpse is dead. You know, it wouldn't be a corpse otherwise. And it's just coming right out of the crotch. You know, and I'm figuring, boy, we're gonna have some censorship problems. But no, it hasn't run into any problems at all. I mean, there's flags of it and posters of it and everything, shirts of it. You know, and it's like, it hasn't run into any trouble. But that one, that concept, see, that's incredible. That's just a great concept.
Yeah.
Because my first guy got a hold of me and said, we got a wild idea. And I said, okay, I hope it's not one more album all about the devil. We just don't need any more albums about the devil. You know, there's been, what, 1,000? Okay, there's enough. What have you got? And he goes, oh, no, this is a science fiction concept, end of the world. They're French-Canadian, so sometimes their syntax was a little different than ours, and certain phrases weren't quite how we would say it. You know, but we could completely communicate. And that was through, if you can say it right, Misaku and Osho Records, however you say it, in, you know, with this title, but yet they're in London, England. And that one went over really big. I mean, the Tomb Mold fans and people who like the really heavy, scary stuff are really into the Sedimentum album. And I'm very proud of it. I highly recommend it because the music is just ripping. It is so, it's like a sledgehammer of gloom. And then on top of that, I'm very, very proud of that painting. That cover painting represents what I'm really wanting to do. Up until this most recent one, the Slime Lord. You know, the concept behind that is a giant amphibious creature of unknown origin that crawls up out of the depths of time and dies. It's the size of a continent. Yeah, and then all these bizarre
like
life
eye with tentacles or something almost.
Well, that's inside it. We don't actually see the creature.
Inside of it. Okay.
Yeah. Inside the creature are five stomachs, and these different life forms have gone in there and set up five different civilizations. That's what the album is about.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. There's bacteriological battlefields. When they were telling me this, my mind was watering like your mouth will when someone describes a steak dinner.
Right.
I was going, yes, you have picked the right guy. You've chosen the right guy. I was so into doing that. Like I said, I was sorry when it was done. Of course, you know, you eventually has to be done to meet the deadline. I was sorry to leave it. I wish that I'd had more time and do an illustrated booklet inside it because the concept really needs that much fleshing out. But the record company, I mean, it was $20 spend, but they were like, we'll see how it does. You know, not going to really go for a booklet inside just yet and that kind of thing. But
hopefully that one comes with a big poster too.
I'm thinking it will. It doesn't drop till March, but the pre-order is happening now.
Yeah, and I already got a grip of them ordered for the store, actually.
Oh, excellent. I'm going to pick one up when I'm at Meteor Gym because it'll be another year before $20 Ben remembers to send me one. Well, it's got to go to the stores first. It's got to go to the pre-order people first. All of that has to be taken care of first. That makes sense. But sometimes it's a year before I get my contributor copies.
I get all that from a business side, but like I'd be like, man, hook the guy that brought this to life up. Like,
yeah, well, an old saying my dad used to say is the psychologist kids were the last to get treatment.
or like mechanics vehicles are the worst vehicles type of thing.
Yeah, the last to get worked on. Yeah. Well, so on the ones I'm most proud of, I did four covers for Argus, and they're kind of if Iron Maiden were a doom band, that's what they're like. I'm looking at my list here. I probably named the ones I'm most happy with, like the Slime Lord, of course, Child Bite coming out. The Coffin Mulch one came out great. So there you go. But I mean, I'm happy with most. There's hardly any of them that I go, ooh, I wish that hadn't, happened. But you know, like some of the old ones, like I did a couple of covers for the Meat Shits. I don't know if you know who they are. They were and you're missing nothing. It's a porno noise grind. You know, it's funny as hell. I mean, you listen to it, it's a party record. It's funny as hell. It's all grind.
Like the Mentors, kind of.
But much faster. I mean, we're talking insane speeds. The songs are like 30 seconds, you know. Their best song is Proud to Be an Asshole, which is about 2 minutes long. And it's the only one that actually strikes you as a real song. And it's all just, you know, as fast as possible. And they all kind of sound similar. But when you put it on and all the sound bites and little bits and things and sound effects and funny stuff they've got on there. You're really entertained, but I wouldn't say it's great music. You know, maybe it's not supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, you can't have everything can't be your magnum opus or whatever they say.
Absolutely true.
Who are some of the artists that inspired you to get into doing the style of stuff that you do, of like being kind of gory, grotesque type of things?
When I was in high school, I was reading underground comic books and heavy metal magazine, and I used to imagine doing, you know, and that's all pretty intense stuff, a lot of blood and guts. And I was really aiming my goals at, I wonder if one day I can be able to do this kind of stuff. And I came close, you know, but it started with that. But as far as artists, I was really into the surrealists from the 1920s, like Max Ernst and Salvador Dali, of course. Everybody goes through a period of liking him. Him and a guy named Yves Tanguy and Kay Sage and some others from a long bygone era. But they were doing stuff that looked fresh until you look at the date and you realize some of it's 1922, 1934. You got to be freaking kidding me.
Yeah.
This stuff is killer. And they were that far ahead of time. So I thought, what does it take to get in that mindset? How do you do something that's way ahead of your time? And of course, I slowly realized they didn't know they were ahead of their time. They were just simply doing their work, the work that they saw fit to do. And that's what I learned from it, you know. But comic book wise, there was a guy named Jeff Jones. I actually talked to him on the phone, and he's a killer painter. I credit him with, when I was looking at his work, I thought, you know what, this clinches it. I've got to learn to paint, because I could draw and I was doing a little bit in ink, but I thought, I've got to go the full gamut, you know, and learn how to paint. And so I give him the credit for that. But my favorite painter is a guy named Ernst Fuchs, who died in like 2015. But you look at his work and swear it's from the Renaissance, except you somehow know that it's modern. You know, he doesn't have cars and things in there, all the stuff like that. But you look at it and can tell, it's like, oh my gosh, you know that this is, you know, 20th and 21st century. But he has got the abilities of Rembrandt and the imagination. He was one of the guys that inspired H.R. Giger. Okay. You know, that'll tell you something. He inspired Bekshinsky and all those guys that people are into now. He was the big inspiration for those guys. And I got into him by accident. I was reading Juxtapose magazine, and I'd seen his name and I'd heard his name, and I've got art books where he's mentioned, but there was no coverage. And then all of a sudden I saw four or five of his pictures and was blown out. But what happened was, it made me realize I've had ideas like this, and I decided, it's way too much, I wouldn't be able to do it. And when I looked at his stuff, I thought, see, this tells me right now I've been wasting time. I've had these ideas that are on this wavelength, not as good as his, but on his wavelength. And that's what I need to be doing. I need to be shifting gears and doing this, you know. And I did. And of course, what came out of it is what you see now, you know. I was already headed that way, but that's one of the big ones. But I like Bernie Wrightson and Steve Bissett, you know, the guys from Swamp Thing, and all of the heavy metal guys like Philippe Druyer and Mobius, of course, and Philippe Kaza. Can't name them all. But I've always been partial to European painters and art and draftsmen and all that stuff, far more than I was the American ones. Didn't even realize it, because sometimes I see the work and find out who did it later. And, you know, 9 out of 10 times there's somebody from Europe. And I thought, God, this is the kind of thing. How do you get your brain to think like this, you know? And that's inspired me the most. So, I mean, I hope that answered your question, but it's not the usual suspects. Most people say you're probably really into Dan Seagrave. I admire him, but he wasn't one of my inspirations, no.
So do you have like when you're going to sit and paint, do you have sort of like your own ritual that you do to get you in that mind space? Like, do you put out music or?
Yeah, I decide what the mood is. Of course, you know, when I told you figuring out the color scheme, that tells me what the mood is going to be, the atmosphere. Atmosphere is key, first off. Develop that before you do all the details and all the gore. You know, it's got to have the atmosphere. And so I look at what music will sustain that atmosphere. And also, I'm a huge movie collector. What movies can I have on in the background that keep this atmosphere rolling? Because if you have something contrary to the atmosphere, it really just slows you down and You know, it's just like, I just can't get in the rhythm. But if I have it going on, so that's why my studio is separate from where my girlfriend and I live, because this would drive another human being crazy. Because maybe I'm working on a painting for 15 days straight. It's the same three movies and the same three CDs, you know, all day long, sometimes for 10 to 15 days in a row to maintain that, which is what I don't get bored with it, because it's kind of in the alpha state. It's kind of in the background, you know. And even when the movies are playing, I see a little bit of it in my head, but I'm not actively watching them. It's just supplying the, you know, I already know what the movie is, and so it's supplying the atmosphere that I need. And it just feeds it like that. But if somebody were here, yeah, it would drive them nuts. You know, it was like, oh my God, you're going to do this again. And there were some times when in my early 20s and stuff, I'd date girls and stuff, and I'd paint in the kitchen, or I'd have a little room in the, you know, where we'd share a house. It would just drive them batty. And that's when I thought, I've got to have a studio. As soon as I make enough money to afford it, I've got to have a studio separate from here, where I just get up and go to work every day, which is what I do now. You know, I get up and what I do is I spend the whole week at my studio in Southern Illinois. And then on weekends, I go and meet my girlfriend in St. Louis, where we have a place. Okay. And it's just that's how we've maintained it. Once in a while, she comes here and she goes, I got to have a break. I think this weekend I'm going to come to your place. And I was like, that's fine. And I take the weekend off usually. I'll paint on Sundays unless she's here or if I'm there. But if we're not doing that or doing, you know, what else? Sundays are usually the start of my week because, I don't know, there's something about Sunday. It's like, yeah, let's get going. Whereas most people would wait till Monday, like today, you know. But unless she and I are together, you know, I do a lot of times pretty much get one of the biggest work days of the week is Sunday. But set the atmosphere, set the mood, and maintain the mood throughout the creation of it. If I'm working on several things at once, I do change up the mood so that the pieces I'm working on don't all look the same.
Right.
I discovered that early on. It's like, oh my gosh, you put these together, they look alike. And I discovered that early in my career. So it's like, oh, got to shift gears. When you shift to another project, shift gears. You know, don't just use the same color. And I was doing that. I have a chair on wheels and I was going around and, you know, it's like, oh, while I've got this color, I'll put it on this painting. And while I've got this one, it'll fit over here. And then you line them up, or you look at them when they're published and go, ooh, you could tell they were all done at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's not
your brain's kind of like on the same wavelength while you're doing it.
Yeah. Cause I wasn't switching up the atmosphere. I wasn't switching it up. See, I learned very quickly to conquer that problem.
Right.
Well, yeah. Long before too many people caught on.
So like musically, you seem to be like a metal guy, or is that what you listen to mainly?
Mainly, yeah. Death and doom. I love when I'm painting, doom metal is perfect. When I'm driving, death metal is much better. But also, and this always surprises people, I like avant-garde jazz. Really crazy stuff from like 1965. That's way under, not the famous stuff, way underground jazz, you know. Like that's real, not noisy, but just so avant-garde, you know, like... kind of like how can I put it? It's abstract, but yet you could hum it, but it's got things coming out of left field, and you never know when the song's gonna be over, and you don't know, you know, the middle section could be completely different and all that stuff. And it's usually, again, European composers. And I'll just pick one and go, okay, let's try it. And if it's good, I mark it, you know, on my TV, and so I can pull it back up again. So metal, avant-garde jazz, sometimes blue, like Delta blues. I sometimes will really get in the mood for that. And those guys are incredible, you know, especially on guitar. And that'll start, you know. So all that together. I don't like country. I don't think it's terrible. I just don't care for it. And I don't like rap. Rap, just, it's all the same beat. And there's no, it's not hummable. It's not, to me, it just, I know other people love it, but it's not memorable in my mind. It's just, I don't know. And it just kind of, I don't know, it just kind of aggravates me. It's kind of like when you walk into clubs. And every song is doots, 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 doots,
yeah,
doots,
yeah, like,
you know,
a techno
beat. That's how it is all night long. Yeah, and it's the exact same beat. They don't speed it up or slow it down. They don't. It's 120 beats a minute, that hypnotic beat, and that's what they keep it at. And it's like, because if you play a record, it's already timed to play at exactly that speed, even if it's not recorded at that speed.
Right.
And it's just a kind of a hypnosis thing. And no, I don't care for that. Like a lot of variety, like up and down, you know.
Yeah, I wouldn't, just by talking to you and, you know, your artwork and everything, I wouldn't take you for a rap fan.
No. I mean, and people say, oh, I'm sorry you think it sucks. I didn't say that. It's just like, I can't relate to it. It just, it doesn't have enough music in it.
Right.
It's, you know, it's just that talking and that beat. And then what music there is a sample lifted from something else. And sometimes it's a record. The sample is lifted from a record I'm familiar with, and I'd rather hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember getting in an argument with a guy. We're talking about bands and metal and stuff. And he says, he felt like it was all overrated. And I said, well, all right, well, what do you listen to? And he told me some group. I really couldn't tell you their name. And he was telling me about how great they were. And he said, he picked out Led Zeppelin as an example of what he didn't like. And I said, oh, what don't you like about Led Zeppelin? So he gave us what he didn't like about it. And I said, we're talking a little bit longer. I said, well, I've never heard of these guys, and I'm into all the music, overground and underground, so I'm curious. And he says, well, when something goes on break, we'll go out to my truck, and I'll play some of it for you. So we walked outside in the bar, and he puts it in there. He's all super proud of it. The song he plays completely lifts from a Led Zeppelin song after he just made that comment. He's not aware of it. And so we didn't say anything. We're looking at each other, and I said, don't say anything. So we listened to the whole thing. I said, well, that was jamming. He goes, yeah, did you catch that guy on guitar? It's killer. I said, yeah, it was. I said, let's go in there, and I'll play something for you. And I went to the jukebox and played that exact same Led Zeppelin song. And this guy's, he could have used a pillow to catch his jaw when it fell off.
Oh, fuck, I'm sure. Man.
Oh, he did everything but piss his pants, you know. And he was just like, whoa, whoa. And I said, yeah, your so-called great band. I said, there's not even a good guitar player in it. They're sampling Led Zeppelin. How about that?
Yeah. You know? And so even Led Zeppelin, trying. I mean, they sampled a lot of their stuff is inspired by blues music.
Oh, yeah, they came from the blues. You know, they did. That's their whole thing was to get the British blues, you know,
yeah.
Delta. All that stuff was really big in England, where it was disappearing, almost gone in America, and then they brought it all back and got those guys some royalties and stuff.
Yeah, so like, yeah, that the Stones Dixon, did that, Memphis Slim, and all that sort of thing.
Oh yeah, the Stones did it too. So anyway, I mean, there was that. Yeah, I didn't mean to get off topic, but it was just hilarious that this guy's just dissing Zeppelin, and then we go out there. that was what was sampled on this music that he thought was the highest level he'd ever heard, you know.
That is funny. So what are some of the bands that, like, metal wise what are some of the bands that you listen to regularly, like, just currently?
I like all the old school and a lot of the new school. I like Ruin, I like Larva, I like Mortuous, but I listen to also a lot of the bands that I, you know, work with, like Flesh Rot. Pale Divine is a doom band I really like, and I did some work with them. Putrid Tomb, although I think they broke up. My Dying Bride, Old Obituary, Coroner. Are you familiar with a band from the 80s called Coroner?
Yeah, Mental Vortex.
Yeah, thrash, but also deathy. Oh, yep. Man, that's... Yeah, that's just every now and then I have to revisit that. DRI, some of the old stuff, you know, when I was a teenager, that got to, you know, revisit that stuff because it kind of opened my brain up. But I also like stuff all the way back to the 60s and all that. I have a really wide taste. I like the psychedelic bands too, like the old ones, you know, like a Strawberry Alarm Clock and all that stuff. Or Iron Butterfly. They have some crazy shit going on.
Yeah. Aside from just their hits, they have a lot more to the band that they didn't get credit for, really.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I like Cyanide. I mean, the list is enormous. You know, I mean, we would just be making, you know, going on and on and on.
Yeah.
But I like the, like I said, when I'm painting, I like the doomier stuff. When I'm driving or hanging out or whatever, I like the faster, gruesome stuff. But to me, like I said, again, the word atmosphere, if it's got that graveyard, creepy atmosphere going on in it, you know, then that's going to suck me in right away. And it's got to be heavy.
Yeah.
You know, so, and so
you said Old Obituary. Do you have something against New Obituary, or is that just kind of
nothing nothing against it? It's just the Old Obituary was when I was super young and it impressed me, and it reminds me of great times.
Right.
And when I want that feeling, I just plug it back in, especially their first two albums.
Yeah, the nostalgia factor I got them, to it. It's a,
yeah,
I think very, like, Slowly We Rot is very, John Tardy's voice was a lot more, I guess, slimy is the way to put it.
Yeah.
Like, not that their record that they came out with a year ago or 2 years ago now was phenomenal. Like, they're still putting out music at a high level, but I get what you're saying. I can agree with
you there. And the thing is, I don't slight the new stuff. I like the new stuff. But, I mean, when I get in the mood, it's going to be those first two.
Right.
You know, there was a lot of bands of Wild Rag Records, which was a real low-budget underground label in California, but they had some a string in about 2 years, a string of just absolutely phenomenal bands that just, you know, that would just blow you away. Bands like At War, Genocide, Blood Feast, Deadly Blessing, Wehrmacht, if you know them, that means War Machine, The Unsane, End Destroy, Executioner, bands like that. That just there was a band called The Recipients of Death that did two albums. The album cover I did for Organic and Fest, the pencil sketch originally, I showed it to Recipients of Death, and they, when I told them what I wanted to do with it and all that, it was going to be in a completely different color scheme too. They said, they said, well, at first we like it, but now we think we're going to go in another direction. So they balked on it. And right after that, I had just finished the Morpheus Descends, and the record company got a hold of me and said, well, you know, I said, well, I do have this drawing ready to go. I said, you know, I could start painting on it here. I'll show you. And I mean, they immediately said, that's it. That's perfect. But we want you to use bright colors. We don't want these grays and sludgies. And that's exactly what it was going to be. It was going to be a real rotted browns and purples, and say, oh, well, all right. So I'll do bright, you know, bright colors. That's what they want. So I did greens and purples and all that stuff. And critically, I got really, really slammed for that, which is funny because I guess it was ahead of its time, because on the reissue that just came out, people are just loving the color. So who knows? I guess it was, you know, it had to wait to find its time. But I got one of the funniest reviews in a magazine I ever got when that album came out. And I did some artwork for a band called Zool, and their guitar player had this magazine. He goes, I got to show you something. I got this magazine in the van, and you're mentioned. I said, oh, great. Let's see. He goes, well, it's not very nice. I said, all right, I'm ready. So the review went on about the Organic and Fest album, and it says, oof, let's look at that cover art. And this is what it said. It looks like Dan Seagrave took the bad brown acid at Woodstock and made his own fucked up Nickelodeon cartoon. So he said, doesn't that hurt your feelings? I said, absolutely not. I said, people now will be climbing over themselves to see what this album cover looks like.
Yeah, it's almost like a better review than what you could have got if he would have talked it up.
Oh, yeah. If it said, you know, oh, it's a richly, and you know, a fantastically enriching painting about man's inhumanity to man and the course of blah, 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 blah. You know, nobody would care about that. Nobody would give to. But no, it turned out to be that sent that one, I'm not going to say into the stratosphere, but it changed, you know, people's mind about it. Because like I said, now when it went on this reissue, it came out last month, people were raving about it. And I was a little unsure. It's not in my power to stop the reissue or anything. And not that I would, but I was thinking, oh, what are people going to say about that cover? You know, and it's technically not up to what I can do now and all that stuff. And people were just going crazy over it. So, you know, my own prejudice or my own fears about it, you know, were not withheld. It didn't matter. In fact, like I said, it was better received now than it was way back then. It certainly was not way back then.
Yeah. I think now, like, in metal especially, like, people have seen every type of variation of, like you said, like, skulls, dead priests, like,
yeah,
you know, shit like that. Like, so now, like, to see stuff that's like yours is fresh to where it hasn't been done a million times, and it, like, at least me personally, like, you know, you don't want to see the same thing over and over and over again.
That's true. Yeah. We don't need any more. And of course, you know, like I said, I don't want to make anybody mad, but how many times have we seen a demon licking an inverted cross, you know, too many times? And how many?
I've been seeing sometimes that all just, my life, man.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just automatic. People go, oh, a death metal cover. Okay. Put a burning upside down cross. Let's have a pen. One of the bands that got a hold of me, their idea was, a pot leaf, but it's a human, like shaped like a human. And he's crucified on a pentagram. And I said, that's really bad. And they go, really? That's not good? I said, no, that's not good. Holy cow.
Oh, man. That's like something you draw on, like, your folder, like, in seventh, yes, eighth grade.
Oh, yeah.
That's funny you said that, because I said that that's what kids draw on the margin of their math homework.
Damn right.
I said that. I actually said that.
Yep.
You know, as a joke.
Oh, man, that's great.
Yes, I turned down all that stuff, you know, unless I can talk them into something better. But a lot of times I go, well, and I said, well, there's a lot of guys who will draw that for you. A lot of guys who can do a good job on that. I said, but it's not me. I said, I'm looking for way, you know, not loftier, better, just more interesting concepts than that, you know.
So if somebody wanted to commission you to paint something like just for their house? Like somebody, can people do that, or do you just do bands and stuff?
I have had private commissions. Yes. I don't do very many of them because it's, you know, to make my living,
right?
I've got to be working, you know, for the book companies and the record companies. It's steady, and it is steady work. It is completely steady. I have done it. It takes a long time for them to get there. There's, I always tell them, I said, you got to get me several months because I'm going to be doing it all on free time.
Yeah. I was just out of curiosity because, like, I hang a lot of stuff around my house. So, you know, like down the road, maybe if I'm like, well, a Brad Moore piece would fit nice right here.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you can always hit me up. Like I said, I just look at my schedule and let you know, the reality of the situation, like how soon it could be done or how long it might take, because I have done it. And I also sell color prints of almost every album cover I've done, and plus some pieces that people haven't even seen. So, you know, you can hit me up.
And that you sell off of?
Yeah, it's just bradmoreartwizard.com. But just actually hit me up on
Instagram,
Facebook or Instagram. Instagram is probably best. Just do that and I can send you pics. And you know, there's a lot there. It's so much better. I think that websites are kind of dropping off the map. They're kind of going out of style.
Yeah, it's kind of like the next generation's version of the newspaper at this point, almost.
I think that you're right. I think, and that a lot of the people that I deal with don't hit up a, because I'll give them my business card and they go, oh, you got a web page. People still doing that?
Yeah.
And I go, yeah. I said, and I'm going to hang on to that for a little bit, because some of the publishers who get a hold of me, I'll say, here, I'll just send you the link to that. You can look through the stuff and then get a hold of me. But I prefer people to get a hold of me on Instagram or Facebook, because I get so much email. It's a couple of hours to go through it. And it's like, oh my God. And it's so much easier on the other things. You know, you get the little notification, just check it out. Usually a few sentences or whatever. It's like, oh yeah. And you can answer right away. And I can kind of do it with my left hand while I'm painting with my right hand, and it works. But with, I don't know what it, I sometimes forget to check my email because it piles up, and it's like, I usually use Saturday to answer all my mail and stuff. Although I'm checking it a couple days a week just to make sure there's no emergencies or something. But, that's what I prefer though. Hit me up on Instagram, hit me up on Facebook. That works better than any of the others, you know, and because there's been things on my webpage and I missed it, you know, and back when I used to list the prints you could buy, I missed some orders, and it's like, how did I miss this?
Yeah.
So it's just better to do it directly, you know?
Okay. Good to know. And good for listeners to know if they want to get over.
How big a prints do you go?
They go as big as 25 to 30 inches and as small as 11 by 17.
There you go.
Yeah, so it's hangable size. If you go bigger than 25 to 30 inches, most people in their apartments and places, they don't have a space for a bigger, because people said, man, you ought to go bigger. I said, well, who would buy it? Where would they hang it? Because Tomb Mold came up with 8-foot flags of the artwork I did for Manor of Infinite Forms. And I have one. When I do my exhibits, a lot of times I have that flag hung up behind me. And it's the whole wraparound cover of the Manor of Infinite Forms, and it's 8 foot long. And they said, yeah, they didn't sell very well. And I said, well, because who has 8 foot of wall space? Really? You're going to run into a window, and somebody's, metalheads live in apartments and stuff, you know, it's where are they going to, or a basement, you know, it's like, well, where are you going to hang that? So, you know, it's not, in my mind, it wouldn't be doable to have them any bigger than that. And usually 25 inches is where I cut it off. But I've had people say, oh, let's do 30 because for reasons, you know, so I have done them 30, but 25 is a little more workable.
Yeah, no, that's a pretty good size, because it's not, like you said, an 8-foot flag, like that's excessive. Like it's a big chunk of space to take up.
Well, yeah. Well, think about it.
But it would be sweet. Like, I'm not saying like I wouldn't hang one up if I had the 8 feet, but I'm just saying like that's a big, like,
and I'm sure they weren't cheap, you know?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I got mine for free, so I don't. When
well, of
people
course
say, well,
you
does
did,
that cost?
I mean,
I don't know.
Probably, like,
yeah,
I would
say
$100 at least, you know, because like a regular flag from a band's what, 25, 30 bucks.
Yeah, just for like a 24-inch tapestry type of thing. I just bought my kid a Mayhem one and a Death one not that long ago, and they were both like $30.
Just for your standard.
Yeah, but the flags, you know, in the old days, all posters were on paper, and we still have that, but the flags beat that, because you can put it away. If it gets wrinkled, you can iron it. You hang it back up, you can frame them, they last. Whereas a poster after a while turns yellow, it gets rips, you put tape on it, which is the worst thing you can do. And, you know, the acid from the tape eats it up. It just, I know they're nice, and I've got old posters that I really treasure. I've got some that are super old that I really treasure. But overall, these flags are like a blessing. They really are. They,
I always
just,
frame my posters so they don't tear away like that. But I do have a really, really old Misfits poster that is older than I am as far as I know. And it's all yellowed. No, it's just like old Glenn Danzig, like young Glenn Danzig sitting on the cover. And I got it from somebody, and it belonged to many other people that we know prior to.
Yeah, I've got a ton of them. That I've got them rolled up in tubes, and with the idea, of course, I've said this for a long time, but the idea of framing them, each one of them, I can do my own framing. I prefer not to, because I've done so many in my life. It's like, sure, somebody else can do this, you know, or just buy one, you know. But I got some of them. When I pull it out to show people, they're blown away, because there's a lot of. There's a psychedelic artist. His name was Nick Hyde. And I actually got to know, he's from the 60s and 70s. And he's incredible. I mean, it's just mind boggling. And he did these big posters that are almost too big to hang, because that was the style back then. The posters were huge. And I got to know him a little bit. We wrote back and forth. He didn't like talking on the phone very much. So we wrote letters back and forth. And when he died, he willed me his magnifying lenses that he used for hyper detail work. And the funny thing is, I thought, man, I'm going to put these in a place of honor and never use them. And right off the bat, I started using them.
Oh, that's cool.
I did. Yeah. And it's, I mean, we're talking, you can get microscopic with this stuff. I've put hidden details in there that it's like, unless somebody else has a, you know, unless they blow the picture up super huge, I mean, super huge, like a big backdrop on stage, some of this stuff will require tiny lenses just for you to find it, you know. And I put that stuff in there for myself, knowing there's going to be a couple of people who will locate, you know, some of these clever little things I stick in there.
Oh shit, that's going to give us something to do.
Yeah, now I'm going to be at home like blowing up pictures on my iPad, like
my magnifying.
They're not in everything, but they're in some. And my girlfriend has caught on to some of it. She goes, "Hey, is this what I think?" I said, "Yeah."
Awesome.
That's cool to know. So we normally ask people a particular question towards the end of the episodes, but you already answered it with your avant-garde jazz comment. We like to ask people what they listen to that people wouldn't expect them to listen to, but you already gave us that little detail there, so I'm not going to bother with that. But before we get wrapping things up here, like, do you have anything that you want to say or get off your chest? All your social media tags and everything will be in the episode description, and I've been keeping a list of the albums that we talked about so I can put all those pictures along with the episode once we post it.
Well, all I would say is that in my life, growing up in a small little country town and all that stuff, that everybody tried to talk me out of being an artist, because they said it's nice and all, but after high school, you need to get in a factory, you need to go into the coal mines. That's all there is for you. And I said, well, that's, if I live around here, I'm going to move away. And they're like, well, how can you move away and leave your hometown? I mean, there was all this programming and hypnotizing and all that stuff that, you know, I knew I was going to have to get away from. So I encourage people, you know, how many young kids are playing basketball and they said, man, I'd like to play for the NBA, but my dad said it's impossible. How do you know? If everybody told everybody it's impossible, we wouldn't have the NBA.
Yeah, nobody would.
Yeah. And so, you know, and I asked my high school art teacher, and she said, you need to go to college to really learn the technical aspects of how to do this. She goes, that can't be covered in a high school class. She goes, but I think you have what it takes. And that's the first person to actually tell me that. And it's like, ding, you seriously? You know, she goes, yeah. She goes, this is what you do. So she kind of wrote some things down, and I followed her advice. And I was even telling my dad and family and all that, and they were all going, oh, son, this will never work. And, you know, because they, in their lives, they thought that you draw a picture and you hang it on your wall. And if it sells, you somehow get some money. They had no idea about reproduction and working for publications and the fact that when something's published, it goes around the world. They had no clue of that at all. And I tried to tell them, but it just wasn't getting in there. So I had to break away, move away, and, you know, do the part-time job thing for a while, and went to art school and made it, graduated. I have a master's degree in painting. And And it taught me, I mean, I've talked to people who said I went to art school and didn't learn anything. That's a shame, because I, the one that I went to was, you know, it was hardcore. It was you're learning this or you're out. I mean, they give you 2 weeks and stuff, and the people who were cut from class, like, get your money back because you're not going to make it through class. It was really diligent. And that was the best thing, because it was like, good, because I'm here to learn, you know. And so I tell people that if you do, I don't want to be like that cliche of, you've got a dream, follow your dream. I'm not trying to say that. But the whole idea is, if you feel inside there's something you need to be doing, it's probably true. It probably is the thing you need to go and do. And so don't let somebody talk you out of it. You know, so many of my friends, you know, married their high school prom date, got her pregnant, had to go into the to a job immediately. And all the things they said they were going to do in their life, they didn't even attempt to, because they had to earn a living and take care of this new baby and blah, 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 blah. You know, it went on. And I escaped all that. You know, I left all that stuff. And I'm glad that I did. There were times I think, boy, you know, everybody else is, you know, they're happy. And all, of course, that's how it looked. And I'm like, I'm still struggling and all that stuff. And I was in my 20s. And I just thought, is this ever going to work? Because you do have doubts. It's like, will it work out? You know? And of course, it did. You know, all I've ever done, other than the part-time jobs that I had when I was in art school, other than that, I have made my living strictly from art. I've been an art teacher a couple of times. I had a murals group in my town where I live, which is Carbondale, Illinois, that went on for a few years. I've done special effects designs for low-budget movies. I did storyboarding for commercials. I did comic books, and off and on still do. And then, of course, off and on until lately did album cover work, and now it's just full-time album cover work, and I freelance some book cover stuff, and it's all made me a good living. I've never been, you know, the starving artist. I've never been starving. My parents and other people said, you'll be, and I'm not down on my parents, I'm just saying, they were warning me, like, you'll be on unemployment 50% of your life. I have never been on unemployment. So I tell people, don't listen to the programming, the hypnotism of, you won't make it. It's because in their minds, they can't picture how it works. So they think that they're helping you out. You know, if there's something you want to do, especially if it's in the arts, go for it. In America, where we are the Henry Ford assembly line, to be the best American you can be is to work in a factory or whatever and be a nameless, faceless, replaceable cog in the machine and die at 51 and leave your kids $6,000, and you are a good American. And that works for some people. That absolutely is their goal, and that's fine. If that's your goal, go for it. It isn't everybody's goal, and don't let somebody, you know, shove that goal down your throat to where you start to believe it.
Yeah, that's a great thing to leave off with, because I wholeheartedly agree with all of that.
Well, it sounds harsh, and I'm not harsh or bitter, not at all, because it worked out for me.
Yeah.
There's a lot of young people that said, man, after a couple of years, I just had to give it up because it wasn't catching on. I said, it took me about between 3 and 5 years.
Yeah, there's a saying out there that says, if you're not willing to put in 5 years of work without making a penny, don't even bother starting.
Yeah. Well, I was making money, but not quite enough to live on. I had to do a bunch of other things. And it was just like, I was teaching art classes. And like I said, doing the murals thing and all that. It was all still art. But I just wanted to wake up. Well, I wanted to do what I do now, is wake up, go over, you know, get out of bed, fix some tea or coffee, go over to my studio area and just get to work, you know, put on some music and movies. And that's what I've been doing for years now. And it all paid off. But it does take a while to get it going. You have to have enough clients who are hiring you on a regular basis. You know,
there's no such thing as an overnight success.
No, there isn't. When people say, you know, they're overnight success, they've already put in 5 to 10 years, you know. And when it comes to getting your residuals and things like that, I tell people, look, you work on something and next year you'll get your residuals. That's just how publishing works. And by year three, you're making money from your first 2 years. So if there's a little gap or something in your commissions, you've got money in the bank. Yeah. I said, so hold out for year three. I said, but more realistically, hold out for year five. And if you really, really care, if this is really the thing you want to do, I said, because if you go away from it, you're going to go forever like, man, I should have stuck it out. I should have hung on longer. What would have happened if I hung on longer? I said, and you will poison your brain with that for the rest of your life. So when you get your chance, just do it. Do it and stick with it. Because if you love it, you should have no choice anyway. You know, if I never made any money at it, I would probably still habitually paint and draw. Because even after a long day, and I'll turn on TV, and while I'm eating stuff, I'll sit there and, or if I'm on the phone with my girlfriend, I'll sit there and sketch on a piece of paper. It just doesn't turn off, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's part of who you are.
Yeah, it is who I am. It's the thing I'm good at. I'm not good at working on cars. You know, I'm not good at the plumbing. You know, I've had to do some of that stuff, you know, as a teenager and help my dad. And I learned, it's like, whoa, this, I'm not cut out for this.
Right. It's a useful skill to have, but not to, not a day-to-day job.
No, well, the guy that can do that and wants to do it and loves it, you know, that part of his brain is turned on, and that's what he goes and does.
Yeah. And there needs to be those people in the world, too.
Like, oh, yeah. Oh, a must. It's just telling people that, well, you've got to shoehorn yourself into that and be that, too,
yeah,
when you're not that person. See, that just doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, the people are going to be who they are. Like, my sister and I are polar opposite people, grew up in the same house. You would never in a million years know that we're related because we are nothing alike, because people are just who they are. Like, but all right, man, we'll let you get going here. And we really, really appreciate you sitting, taking the time to talk with us. It's been really cool, really informative. I got a long list of things to check out and whatnot here now.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. The painting I'm working on right now and rounding the corner on, right, like in a week to 2 weeks, it'll be finished, well, probably less than that, is the new one for Obscene. Are you familiar with Obscene?
Yeah, I've heard the name thrown
around. Yeah, this will be their next one on Nameless Grave Records, so I wanted to put a shout out to that. And coming up this year, well, after Slime Lord comes out in March, I'll have Child Bite and Funerary Outlook, which is a brand new band. And I did... like I said, the Child Bite one, I think, is one of the best covers I've ever done. So I can't wait for that to drop and see what the reactions are. And they're not really death metal. They're a strange kind of, it's metal, definitely, but they're a strange, fast, Voivod-ish kind of stuff. I mean, they're unique. They really are unique. It took me a little bit of getting used to their music, you know, and it's just like, you know, I'm really curious to see, you know, if it gets my stuff out there to a different crowd, or if it's going to be the same crowd, and what people think of the artwork, because I think it's just one of the best I've ever done. And the Funerary Outlook.
To seeing that.
Yeah, and well, and the one I'm working on now is coming out terrific. I mean, as I'm working, I'm just thinking, yeah, man, you know, this one's also cooking. But my next project after this metal cover is I've got a project going on for a book company and two comic book companies. So the next couple projects starting in March won't be metal related. They'll be the book cover stuff. And then probably, I don't know. I mean, there's things on the books right now, but all possibilities. I haven't signed any paperwork yet, but probably by April or so, I'll be back to doing metal again.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's how it goes, though.
But yeah, I mean, thank you for all that you do for metal. Like, some of these albums wouldn't have the touch that they do without your hand in it.
Well, that's a very nice thing for you to say. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I appreciate you jumping on here, man. I learned a lot.
Well, thank you very much.
And you enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll talk to you soon.
Okay, great. And you do the same.
All right.
See ya.
Bye.